You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, December 18th, 2013, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
And we have a special guest this week, George Robb. George, welcome back to The Skeptic's Guide.
Nice to be back. Hi, everybody.
Hey, George. Hello. George.
Hello.
Microphone.
Hello. Oh, thank you.
Hello.
George has agreed to join us for the 2013 year-end wrap-up episode.
Is that what this
where
is?
Where we talk about all the wonderful things that happened in 2013, both skeptical, science, and SGU related.
First, let's talk about what happened in the very distant past, because today is the day this podcast comes out, December 28th. Back in 1895, on December 28th, the birth of cinema occurred. The Lumiere brothers, some of the earliest filmmakers known, held their first public film screening. They had previously done a private viewing of some of their short films, but this was the first time that the public was able to come and buy tickets and sit and watch their films. And when I say short films, I mean really short films, like
50 seconds?
A minute, yeah. Yeah.
Two frames.
Yeah, not a whole lot of time to build a story arc. The stories were things like, people leaving our factory on bicycles.
Yeah, like, okay.
Yeah. Yay.
Where's the action?
But, you know, it was the best film that had come out thus far, so points for that.
So they had that going for them.
Yeah. So from that to The Hobbit, the end.
Yeah, a lot of people think they were the first with their device, the cinematograph. They actually saw Edison's device and improved it. Edison's was the kinetoscope, but his was merely just for like one person to kind of, it wasn't for a mass audience, but there were other ones. There was a chrono photography device, a kinetoscope, pleograph, bioscope, most of these before the Lumieres, but their main distinction though is to bring it, you know, cinema to the masses, which is mm-hmm. obviously huge.
Rebecca, how long did it take them before they, you know, started shooting porn?
3 to 4 days. Yeah. They had to gather the... Yeah,
not
well,
long,
yeah.
Huh?
Casting. Casting took a while.
It was casting, mostly. Yeah. Yeah. It's casting tough couch. To sell that. It's like, okay, now you saw this short film of, you know, it was 60 seconds of people leaving a factory. We're going to do that, but you're going to be ejaculating into someone.
Okay.
And you have 60 seconds.
Starting
it's a tough sell.
Now.
It's a tough sell.
So, they wanted guys with the exact opposite stamina
right.
as today, right?
Right. Right. You needed to come immediately and on cue.
It's also tough with the coal-driven sex toys.
I think that's
steam-powered.
Yeah. Steampunk.
No, they were gerbil-powered.
Oh, no.
Oh.
No.
Oh, nice.
No. Oh, my God. You just ruined my night.
Mm-hmm. Steampunk. They actually came out with color. They were really focused on getting color working in 1907, I think. But apparently not much happened with that because color came out way later than that.
They revolutionized color photography, I think, and tried to add that to – like that's what their factory did, I think, was photography stuff.
That's not going to go anywhere, cinema.
Yeah,
it's a fad.
It's
just a fad.
It's a fad.
All right, guys. So we're going to start out this segment by talking about the best and worst of 2013. George, as our guest this evening, you can hit us first. So just anything in the skeptical verse that stuck out for you in 2013.
One thing that sort of interested me, just because of its timing, not necessarily a commentary on the subject itself, but the fact that we were alive when a pope resigned was really fascinating to me. The fact that Pope Benedict, think mm-hmm. what you will of who he is and his history and everything, but just the fact that for the first time since 1415, Pope resigned, and it's actually the first time since 1294 that a pope, like, voluntarily resigned. That was pretty amazing to sort of see that happen, and I don't think a lot of people really, it didn't really register huge of a deal this actually was in terms of its rarity. So that was pretty, that was pretty fascinating to kind of be alive, and especially sort of an observer from the outside as a recovering Catholic, to kind of watch that and think, wow, that's a pretty huge deal.
Yeah, but actually I think it's better than the alternative, which is they stay in office until they're so decrepit they can't function. I mean, like, John Paul definitely was past his prime, you know, for the last 10 years.
Let's put it mildly.
Of his papacy. I mean, come on.
It was rough to watch him in action those last few years.
I mean, it's curious the way everything lines up with all of the sort of the sex scandals and things like that. There's that film that came out too, that HBO, I think, did a documentary called Mea Mega Culpa, which kind of was really, really a bad, bad story or display of Ratzinger's history and how complicit he was sort of in a lot of bad stuff. So that was curious to me that lined up sort of at the same exact time that this documentary comes out and he's sort of, oh, I'm done for the first time in 700 years. All right, catch you later. I'm going to go golf for a while. So that was curious. But it's almost like the Vatican finally caught up to the 19th century. You know, and thought, okay, yeah, let this guy retire instead of just wait until he's a box of jerky.
That's an interesting idea. So do you think that because it happened recently, that other popes might do it, going, hey, you know, I'll give you five precedent. Years and then I'm out. Yeah,
it could be. Yeah, precedents, you know, that's the way precedents work. But I mean, this the Francis now is monstrously popular, so he might be around for quite a long time. It's funny how, like, the new popular guy is popular because he's being nice and sort of, yeah, almost like in the 20th century as opposed to 21st century, even, you know, saying that we should be nice to each other. It's amazing how successful now this guy is and how well he's doing by just being sort of normal. it's fascinating.
We did get some emails from our listeners expressing their favorites. So let's start with favorite interview. The favorite interview is a Michael Mann, got a few votes. This is the climate change guy. That was an excellent interview. I
sure
agree.
Was. Mm-hmm. He's on my list.
And Sanal Adamaruku, I think, got multiple votes. He also was excellent. That we only aired about half of the interview that we did. We'll have to put the rest of that interview up on premium content.
Definitely.
He was fascinating just to hear his whole story. Yeah, very captivating. The whole story of him, the way they tried to kill him. They tried to
literally.
Kill him.
It was a setup.
Literally.
The whole story was about him being set up and him avoiding the setup.
Yeah, and then they ran him out of the country. He's living in exile. Unbelievable.
I think about that interview we did with him and his situation when I'm having a bad day and I realize that I don't have bad days.
Oh, when somebody gets snarky to you on email?
I get downright like freakishly mad if I'm like 45 minutes past a meal. If I'm late, for God forbid, I'm late eating lunch and I'm like banging desks and yelling at people.
Okay.
No. There was one vote for what is also my favorite. Actually, there's two votes. Two votes for Don McLeroy.
He was my choice.
Yeah, just because we don't do that many hostile interviews, and it was a very friendly hostile interview.
Yes.
But it was loved the insight into the workings of the true believer, like to see the motivated reasoning happening in real time, you know?
Yeah, and Don was a particularly game interview, and I mean, to the point where he was practically... He was transparent in a lot of ways, like purposefully transparent. Like, this is where I'm coming from. This is what I'm thinking. This is why I'm thinking it. You know, I think that's what made him such an interesting interview.
Yeah. It's just,
I find him to be a completely fascinating individual.
Yeah, I think part of it is he is legitimate in his own thinking, meaning that he believes what he's saying. And I also think that he is slightly aware that he's being a little dodgy.
Yeah,
he's making some excuses for that here and there.
What were you guys, other than McLeroy, any other votes? The other only other mention that an interview got was Kara Santamaria got one vote as well.
Yeah, Kara.
She was good.
That was a fun interview.
She's fun.
She is hysterically funny. She's crazy smart, like just an awesome person.
Lively. She kind of lightens up a room. It was very, very kind of just fun to be. You couldn't help but smile when you're around her.
I voted for Sanal's interview. That I was, like Evan said, I was captivated. I couldn't get enough of that story, and he told it in such an interesting way. You know, you could see it from his perspective. So he definitely got my interview of the year.
George, I remember you talking about that when he did his presentation at TAM and how you were like, just like, what is there left to say? And you were like totally taken aback.
I was overcome. I actually couldn't, I was getting worried that I wouldn't be able to finish what I wanted to say after his talk, because I was actually sort of emotionally like overwrought, because it was such an important, it just floored me that here's a guy who is literally willing to put his life and his family's life on the line for what he believes in. And we here in the States, or, you know, at least in the Western sort of countries, get very spoiled and get to complain about, you know, the fact that lines at the toll booth are long. And here's a guy who, mm-hmm. you know, like really puts his money where his mouth is. And mm-hmm. boy, I was overcome. And the fact that he was just this gentle little, almost like a figurine you would get somewhere. You know, he's just this polite, kind guy. And his backstage, his biggest concern was that he wanted to come across as legitimate. He was worried that the audience would be hostile and not believe that he's the real deal. So he was sort of telling me, maybe you might want to say that I spoke with Randy before, and he said that what I'm doing is important. And I was saying, believe me, everybody's going to be on your side. You're going to be totally fine. They're going to love you. Don't worry about it. So
what a cultural difference though, huh, George? Humbling.
Completely. Isn't that, completely. Yeah.
It's just strange that he would even say that, because that's what he's used to. Like, I wouldn't think for a moment that someone would like be disingenuous about that type of story.
Yeah, but this is a guy, you know, the last time he stood in front of 1,000 people, they wanted to kill him, literally. So like here he is in front of 1,000 people just to have that mass of humanity. He's thinking, no, this is, please let them know that I agree, because that's his sort of his mindset and his training. And it was humbling. And your interview with him also, it illuminated all that really, really well, too.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Hey, you know, let's cut to it. He's one of my skeptical heroes, and I don't really have that many. He really is one of the biggest in my life right now.
It was my choice, for this show, too, to say him, just because, you know, because of everything.
We do appreciate all the people who let us interview them this year. We had a good lineup of interviews, but there were definitely, some highlights.
I just wanted to give a mention to Gerald Posner. We did an interview with him. That guy, just the way he talks, I don't know what it was. It's like very soothing. I could just listen to him like for days. It was just so easy to listen to. And he gave such great insight into not just the typical JFK and what happened, but into Lee Harvey Oswald. That was
he's encyclopedic.
Stuff I did not know at all. That was just a fascinating interview. Loved it.
Oh, I just like John Ronson's interview also, because he admitted that he was drunk previously. So that I enjoyed very much. Yeah.
That's always a good thing.
That was the vote that I got in on Twitter. Someone mentioned John as one of their favorites, and he was on twice. And I had a lot of fun, especially at the second one with him and Simon Singh together.
Yeah.
That was the Nexus private recording. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah. I like the when we have two people on at once at the live shows, get more interaction going there. Yeah. Let's move on. Favorite SGU episode. There tends to be a recent episode bias when we do this, but.
Absolutely.
So we got to vote for 429. They liked the IPCC, the climate change discussion, Monsanto.
Yeah.
And proper study design. There was a vote for 423 because of the, this was when we were discussing, the Indian rationalists shot dead, which we will talk about more later in the show. 434, discussing Kevin Trudeau going to jail.
404, live from Nexus 2013. Mm-hmm. Kathleen Carr on stage with us. She was really, really funny.
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, that was one of my choices, too. I loved Kathleen Carr.
And it was the only time the five of us were together.
Physically together this year.
Yeah. Physically together at a show.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed the TAM live show. It was... having John Rennie on. John Rennie, I love the guy. He's such an awesome, fantastic guy. Having him there was great. And of course, I gave an awesome discussion about the end of life on the Earth.
Yeah.
Definitely the highlight.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Of course. Then we talked about scrotal evolution, which
yeah,
was
that was
funny.
Awesome. That was funny.
And then interviewed with James Randi, which was not temporarily there, but it's in the episode. And that was fantastic as well.
Since you bring up that episode, that gets my nod for the funniest line of the year, that at least the one that sticks out in my memory, was Evans junk DNA.
Yeah.
It was brilliant.
Oh, yes. It was brilliant.
Talking about someone scrotal, has to say these things. George, scrotal DNA. You remember that one?
Oh.
Yeah.
Junk DNA.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that was one of the funniest moments. I'd say that live show at TAM was one of my favorites, if not my favorite, for the same reasons. John Rennie is, you know, I love talking to him before we go on as well. Like, he's there to, he's just fun beforehand. Like, he's getting himself prepared, and we're cracking jokes even before we got on stage and everything. So that was a really fun show for me.
He's a consummate professional, as long as we've known him, which is a long time, as far as skeptic years go. That he's just always ready to go no matter what. And he helped. Mm-hmm. He was a huge help, huge part of the martial arts workshop that I did with him at TAM as well. And, you know, he was breaking boards and just, you know, breaking down the physics of it all and just, you know, so into it. And it's a side of John that, you know, he doesn't always get the chance to talk about, but he's a, you know, serious martial artist. And it was really a great time to be with him on both stages.
I would say I would put John, and I can't think of anyone else, I would put John at the level of George Robb. Like, those two guys to me are like the best people that I've met in, you know, in this whole endeavor.
Stop it. Stop it.
Well, stop it, you.
I'm not kidding. I'm not
is that
kidding.
Blush? What is that?
George or red? That could just be the lighting.
it is the light, yeah.
So we'll move on. So this is sliding into favorite bit of the year. So any other jokes or comments or segments that stick out for anybody?
I think my favorite thing that I produced for the show this year was episode 400, the NASA intro.
Oh, yeah.
I forgot about that.
Yeah.
Me too.
That came out better than I anticipated, and the sound effects on there and everything, it was fun for me to make it, and I love how it turned out.
This is Rogue Leader, checking in from Sierra Gulf Uniform Mission Control. I need a news item status report. Please identify.
Echo 3 to Echo 7. Handle, buddy, do you read me? Steve, this is Rogue 4. Copy.
Yeah, Rogue 5 here, I guess. I don't know. I'm here. Why do we have to talk like this, Steve? Steve?
This is Rogue Leader, Rogue 5. Call me Rogue Leader. Can you please identify? That means use your code name. Over.
Yeah, I'm refusing your stupid order. Over.
This is Rogue Mandelbrot. Over.
Rogue Mandelbrot, I don't recognize your...
My favorite thing, and I think one of the best jokes that I came up with this year was the... Well, you want me just to play it for you guys?
Sure.
Absolutely.
The electron shells are quantal, right? It's a quantum. You have to go from one very specific state to another very specific energy state. It gives off the exact same amount of energy in each photon, and that equals a frequency of light. And so neon always gives off that exact same frequency of orangey red light. Other gases, of course, will give off different energies, and they give off different colors. Right. So
that's right. Exactly right, argon. Steve. That's good. That's very good.
Thank
Steve.
You, Jay.
That's kind of how a laser works, in the sense where you have the population inversion, where the electrons jump to higher levels and then they spit out the electrons and they go back to their ground state. But they're all in the
good
same
point,
frequency,
Bob.
Though. What's very, very specific. Yeah, they're like, it's probably beams, so that's what it's a laser.
Right.
So, similar. Steve, are you saying that the electrons rock down to Electric Avenue and then they take it higher?
That's exactly what happens, Jay.
Now, you should write a song. God,
you
that,
could
Jay.
Tell what nice. Gas. Is
that
in...
was. I gotta give that one credit. Actually, that
Wait,
was good.
Yeah,
that was really good.
Just like totally riff off of that.
I'm a fan.
Yeah, well, Jesus.
Of course. Come on.
It was a good one, though. That was a good one.
It was pretty damn epic. I will never be able to weave something that apropos in again. That is it.
The only real listener favorite that came out of the responses was the episode where we talked about PETA claiming that chicken wings shrink your penis.
There's a lot of rage. All I remember is just raging about that.
Yeah.
I remember after we recorded that episode, I'm like, oh, crap, I forgot to make my cock joke on that one.
Don't you hate that?
A time machine.
You got a joke queued up and then it goes by and you forget it. Oh, I hate that.
Nice, George.
The other one that got to mention was a recent one again, when we were talking about Silver Brown had died, and we were talking about the ISON comet, that didn't make it around the sun. And Rebecca and Evan, yeah. I think, were making fun of Sylvia Brown. And Rebecca, remember you, Rebecca, you said, someone's f***ing that comet.
I did say someone's f***ing that comet, yes.
Sylvia Brown predicting the death of Comet ISON.
Not proud of it, but I said it.
That was a good line. It's a good line.
She's dead.
Someone sent me a message via Facebook and said that they rarely laugh out loud on the podcast, but when rarely. Steve was talking about cheetahs during a science or fiction segment, and I quipped, cheetahs never win. They just thought that
that's what did it for him.
That's it.
That was it.
Of all cheetahs, well, never win.
Everyone's I didn't get that joke puns. Until right now.
All right, so we're going to do the skeptic win of the year. This could be a person, an event, or whatever. And then we're going to do the flip side of that, the skeptical jackass of the year. But we'll start with the positive. So who do you guys think was, what was the biggest win that we had this year in terms of the skeptical movement?
I had a science win that I thought was really inspiring and something that isn't necessarily skeptical, but it's a science win. And it was that story, I believe you guys talked about it. It was the story about Emma Brooke, who was a little girl that had leukemia. And the doctors modified some HIV virus to attack the leukemia, and it like healed her. It cured her. That story to me is everything that the best of humanity can possibly offer. And what's cool is this girl is, she's in Phillipsburg, PA, which is just about 15 minutes from here. So she's a local, it's a local story for me. So when I heard about that, it was one of those things of taking this horrendous virus and modifying it to attack the leukemia cells, and it worked. And to me, it's like, it's this inspiring moment of technology and science and guys and people that think really smart and really, really well solving a problem. It's like the most hopeful story. Cause we sort of, you know, we in the skeptical community, we have our little fights and our arguments, and we convince people that, you know, the statue's not actually bleeding. It's ketchup and it's not a ghost. That creaking sound is not a ghost. And that feels great in the moment. And it's important to do that kind of stuff. And it's important to push our skepticism as much as possible. But then you turn around and you see a story like this, where this little girl's life is saved because of science, because of right. someone thinking critically about the problem and not shying away from the stigma of HIV or AIDS, or thinking like, oh, we must never ever touch that because it is a horrible, but thinking, no, wait a minute, maybe we can use it to our advantage and we can cure this little girl of leukemia, and it actually freaking works. That to me is like the most hopeful kind of story that you can have in the year.
Similar to that, George. Just from a pure science point of view, I think the one very important landmark this year was this was the year that it was shown that people who have HIV have a normal lifespan with modern treatment.
Oh, right.
Right.
Yeah.
HIV doesn't even decrease your life expectancy. That's incredible. How that. So we went from three decades ago, the early 80s, it was a fairly rapid death sentence.
Death sentence, yeah.
We had, it was a completely, you know, a new virus. We had no idea about it. And good old reductionist science, we figured out what the virus was, how it worked.
Yes.
We immediately repurposed some drugs to at least knock it back a little bit. Within 10, 15 years, we had an armamentarium of highly active antiretroviral therapy. Another 10 years after that, it's basically a chronic illness that doesn't even reduce your life expectancy. That's
it becomes mundane. It becomes mundane. And the level of success, imagine if someone touting some kind of a therapy that involves petunias, you know, said he could cure AIDS and then does. You would never hear the end of that person saying how fantastic their thing is. Mm-hmm. But here it's like, oh, well, okay, actually, yeah, HIV, you can kind of live with it now because of science. You know, it's
not because of homeopathy.
Right. Or because of
acupuncture.
Spirits.
Not because of anything else. Because of science.
Also this year that doctors treated a baby with HIV and got the child to the point that the HIV seems to have vanished, and she's been off meds now for quite a while. And I think it was announced back in October or September that she's effectively quote unquote cured of HIV, which is pretty remarkable as well.
Pretty amazing.
Well, the thing I was going to mention that is nowhere near as profound as those two items is that the Australian skeptics, you know, led by Dr. Rachey and a slew of other people, you know, forced the AVN, the Australian Vaccination Network, to have to change their name so that this is being pushed through the legal system there. They tried to repeal it. They couldn't repeal it. That's good skepticism. That's good science.
Right.
And those are the places that skeptics need to be in order to help innocent, uneducated, or you know, people that just don't lack the depth of knowledge that they need. Now, those people are the ones that are going to be suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was a profound win for us.
Absolutely. Yeah. They're kicking ass down there in Australia. And Rachel Dunlop got a vote from one of our listeners as well. So, yeah. So other people, too, recognized what a good job she's doing. Our listeners also some votes for Sunal Adamaruku, again, because of his amazing heroic story. I would add to that Dr. Narendra Dabhulkar. Now, he's also an Indian rationalist who was shot dead because of his beliefs, right? This guy literally...
Yeah, he was my pick for Skeptic of the Year.
I mean, if
literally
you die...
For
if you die to promote our cause, I mean, how could you not be the Skeptic of the Year? You know what I'm saying? I mean, hopefully that will never happen again. But, and he knew he was putting his life on the line. We just don't face that, you know, over here. At no point in time do I think, my life could be threatened because I'm promoting skepticism. You know, at worst, you know, maybe my career might be threatened, but not my life. We definitely have to, in my opinion, mention Narendra.
Eugenie Scott?
Mm-hmm.
She retired this year as the executive director of the National Center for Science Education, and I think she deserves some kind of lifetime recognition.
Oh, yeah.
If, you know, like a lifetime achievement award for all the work that she has done tirelessly in being the, I don't know, probably the leading critic of younger creationism and intelligent design in the skeptical movement. It can't be understated. So she's tremendous.
And she has style.
Two others, Donald Prothero.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Stephen Jay Gould called Prothero the best punctuated equilibrium researcher on the West Coast. This year, he authored three books, Reality Check, Abominable Science, which he wrote with Daniel Loxton, and a book called Bringing Fossils to Life. And he was also awarded the 2013 James Shea Award by the National Association of Geoscience Teachers. He is also a tireless defender of science, reason, and skepticism.
He had a good year.
He certainly deserves mention. Had a big, big year, I think, and has really stepped up into being a superstar in skepticism. And I'm also going to give an honorable mention to Dave Gorski, who, you know, Steve, you know, I think between you and him, I can't figure out who's more of the blogging machine. It's kind of, I think you perhaps have an edge on, but I think in a close second is probably David. He also does a tremendous work on the blogs. But look, also, you know, he was bold enough to take Penn Jillette and tell her to task for having gone on the Dr. Oz show. And I think it takes some serious courage, honesty, to come out and criticize, frankly, someone who's kind of in your own camp for having made a really bad decision.
David Gorski is one of the under-recognized skeptics laboring away in the movement. You're right, Evan. He manages science-based medicine. You know, he's the managing editor. He does basically all the heavy lifting. He is a blogging machine. As you say, he helps run, you know, all of the science-based medicine workshops and panels and stuff that we do. He does excellent work. He knows his shit. He's just a good, solid, workaday skeptic. You know what I mean? He's not embroiled in any controversies or anything. You know what I mean? He just does a good job consistently.
Right. Nose to the grindstone, head down, barrels forward, gets it done. He's really great. Someone to admire. So those are my names.
Some of our listeners gave a nod to Michael Spector's New Yorker piece criticizing Dr. Oz. That was nice. Recently, the Texas Board of Education did approve the evolution-friendly textbook. That was another mention.
Yeah, I mean, Steve, I work closely with you. And I say this whenever I get the chance. I mean, you work incessantly. You write multiple blogs a week. You're the editor of this podcast in more ways than, you know, you're the pre-production editor, the post-production editor, and all the activity that you and I manage for the SGU. You definitely are giving all your free time away to skepticism, and I look up to you because of it.
Jay, so do you, man.
Yeah.
You are also one of these nose-to-the-grindstone skeptics who I mean, nobody really knows this but me, but Jay puts in hours of work a day, doing all of the various things to keep the SGU going, to work on our new projects, developing our skeptical outreach.
How about our new website?
Talk
about a skeptic win. I think that's noteworthy and newsworthy as well. I mean, no, really, it really came. It's been a long time. It's hard. It's been years, I know, in the making and so forth. But once it launched and once it was up and everything, unlike healthcare websites and stuff, this one actually worked.
Yeah.
Right. Made sense. It needed some tweaking along the way. But I'm serious. It makes the work you guys have put into that is just incredible for everyone, the community as well. So that's no small task.
Yep. Thanks to Jeremy and Joel for helping us on that as well.
No, let me just say, as someone outside of the five of you, that the five of you are the gold standard in terms of, we forget, or I think we get inured as to how much work the five of you actually do week after week, because it is so consistently good and just so consistently exists. So as someone on the outside, I know it's weird to toot your own horn, but please throttle your horn as tootily as possible, because you guys deserve all the tootelage you can muster. All five of you.
Thanks, George.
Thanks, George.
Thanks, George.
Thanks, George. And you too, by the way.
Yeah, definitely. George, I listen, I am a fan, F-A-N, of your podcast. I don't miss an episode, and I adore the character that you have on your show. It's awesome. It's one of my things that I have to digest every week. I get pissed when you give a short episode. That's how much I like your podcast.
Well, thank you.
But, guys, we have a very vibrant and rich skeptical community, and there are a lot of people out there that work their ass off.
Mm-hmm.
The Tim Farley is another example of someone you can clearly see that guy is working himself night and day to do all the different things that he accomplishes. And we could easily list 100 skeptics that are, not as publicly known and just not even looking for anything like that. They just want to do the work and be a part of the community. And we're all part of that community. I have an obligation to it, and a lot of other skeptics feel that same weight and obligation. And I applaud the success of our community and the fact that we've made it through a lot of these hard times over the past few years. We've had a lot of disruptions, a lot of, unfortunate things take place and everything, but we're still here. We're still growing. We're still making a difference in the world, and that's it. That's why we're here.
So maybe the skeptical community is the skeptical win of the year. We're still here. We're still moving forward.
Like that Time Magazine Person of the Year is you.
You.
BS
yeah,
that's
thing.
Right.
The Skeptic of the Year is you, listener. No, but seriously, I mean, we would be nothing without the community. It seems cheesy to say that, but it's definitely true. And again, there's tons of people that work hard just because they care, just because they care about what we're doing. All right, Love Fest is over. We're going to move on to some other things. Oh, yeah, so we got to do Jackass of the Year. So this is just person who, really deserves to be pointed out as somebody who just is anti-science, anti-rational, who harms the world because of what they're doing.
I've got a good one, and obvious. James McCormick, the complete and total jackass that made the fake bomb detector thousands of people killed.
Mm-hmm. Sure
did. Big. Good one, Jay. Very good.
Jailed. Off to jail this year.
Yep. He deserves a mention.
His product was called the ADE-651. It was a freaking golf ball scooper or something like that.
Finder,
right?
Golf ball finder.
Golf ball finder, total novelty piece of crap. What kind of pseudoscience is that, Steve, where you take a picture of something and you put it inside the device? It was a divining rod.
Well, that's the animism. Is that animism?
It's the essence. Yeah, he would say it transfers its essence, and the mechanism was basically a divining rod. Yeah, divination. He deserves a mention. Kevin Trudeau, like every year, because for the same reason, just because he's a con artist. He's kind of in my pantheon of jackasses. It doesn't need to get brought up again every year.
Stanislaw Brzezinski.
Yeah, the listeners
is an obvious choice.
Obvious choice. A lot of listeners voted for Brzezinski. Absolutely. He was somewhat prominent this year, so he definitely deserves to mention. Deepak Chopra, again, it's like almost every year he's on the short list. Still a little bit
extra
away.
This year for him, though. Yeah,
yeah,
right, right.
Also, I'd like to mention the a couple of popularizers of the feel good pseudoscientific bunk: Oprah Winfrey and Dr. Oz.
Yeah.
You know, they have a massive...
I like that Oprah Winfrey makes the list. She hasn't been on television like in 5 years or something.
Her legacy continues.
Nothing.
Yeah, but I can't, yeah. I can't let it go, Rebecca. I cannot give her a pass on you. I mean, she's just done so much damage that it's a lasting effect on our lives.
No, I agree.
On that same page, you have to point out Katie Couric, too, who recently had the anti-vax episode on her show, which was some of the most damaging sort of anti-science talk that could have happened on a very high-end show with someone that should just know much, much better, and then had a sort of a non-apology. And I think that's again Oprah's influence seeping into someone like Katie Couric, who was, you know, supposed to be a news person.
Oh my God, that's so scary. Somebody's at such a high level of exposure.
Yeah, right? A veteran here. We have this is a person that should be a journalistic veteran and be able to humble themselves.
She's supposed to be informed.
Well, and she normally is. That's what made it particularly bad, I thought, is that Katie Couric is 100% usually an ally of skeptics and people who want to promote science. You know, she's the one who had a colonoscopy done live on television. Like, that's incredible. So it's particularly bad coming from her because she's someone that I think a lot of scientists and doctors saw as someone who was on their side.
Well, let's throw The View in there too for their failure to hire Jenny McCarthy to join their team.
Got a couple votes too. I'm going to bring up one maybe not so obvious one, but we did talk about this year in terms of Jackass of the Year. The parents of the baby that they claimed was a victim of spontaneous human combustion, and any healthcare worker who bought into that for a nanosecond, collectively, the Jackass of the Year. I mean, babies do not burst into flames spontaneously.
And multiple times they brought this suffering child, victim, to the hospital, and they kept sending the child back home with these people. What is the matter? Because of their belief in spontaneous human combustion. Ugh, so disappointing. You're right, Steve.
What's the harm? That's the harm.
Well, guys, let's move on to the science news in review for 2013. This is where we're going to talk about our favorite science news items of the year, the most surprising news items, science news items, and maybe some not so good news items, science news items for the year.
I got to say, last week I did an interview with the Filipino free thinkers, Red Tani. And Red asked me what my favorite science news, like the biggest science news story of 2013, what was it? And I completely drew a blank. And I'm like, I don't know. there's too much I need. And as I was looking through them this week, I realized that there wasn't any like huge, there were a lot of like interesting stories. Obviously we had things to talk about every week, but as for like one standout giant new revelation of a science news, I couldn't really land on one. Like, to me, the most like spectacular thing that happened in my mind was probably the Russian meteor crashing.
That got a lot of votes. Yeah,
that was my number one.
That was big. It was spectacular.
Well, I know that it was initially announced in 2012, but the confirmation that Voyager left the solar system happened this year, and you know,
it left
you can
at
easily
least four times.
Yeah, it did. It did keep coming out and everything, but we had the confirmation.
But we really mean
this
it this time.
It for sure left.
As far as I'm concerned, it happened this year because we could with this. You know, we're very sure that it's gone outside the boundary of our solar system, and you know, they're picking up. It's sensing things that are odd out there. You know, like just, you know, different than inside the solar system or inside the influence of the sun. So to me, that just the fact that that object is out there with that golden record and all that happening to me is just so profound.
We are an interstellar species, sort of.
No, Jay, I agree. That was definitely on a top three list for me. it was very frustrating because of this back and forth, yes, no, yes, no. So it made it very frustrating. So I think that definitely counts as a 2013 Jake, because we didn't know until 2013 that it really, really was out there. And that's something that is a huge milestone. Something man-made in interstellar space. We will not see that except for maybe Voyager 2, but we won't see that again in our lifetimes, I don't think. I'm almost guaranteed we will not see that again for quite some time.
Speaking of lifetimes, the significance of Voyager 1 and 2 is that it has been around for our entire lives. I mean, I can't remember a time when I didn't know about Voyager. It's been with me for as long as I've been.
It launched in 1977, or 1 and 2 launched in 77, so it's...
Well, I'll throw another news item that was big. Comet ISON, was a big, in terms of astronomy, and there was a lot of good astronomy stuff. That had to be one of the biggest. This was a pristine object from the Oort cloud. First time in the solar system.
The heliopause.
The data we're getting from that we'll be studying for years, even though it kind of fizzled out and was extremely disappointing visually for Earth gazers, people on the Earth trying to see it. It was still such a huge win and a big, big story.
You know, along similar lines, but in the biological realm, there was the cicadas this year that were hugely
what
hyped.
What happened with that?
I don't know.
I have that down. That's my biggest fizzle of the year. I didn't see a single cicada. And I had recipes lined up. I was ready to eat them.
We were.
Recipes. Oh, my God. That's right. But wait, not just that. I don't remember seeing, besides the pre-hoopla, while it was happening, I don't remember watching TV and seeing, look at all these cicadas in Wyoming or whatever. I didn't see any of that.
Could you hear them?
What about you, George?
I could hear them at my parents' house. My parents are in northern Jersey, and I could hear them off their deck. And that reminded me of being younger and hearing them when I was younger. That kind of that buzz, that distant buzz hum that sounds like a massive train miles and miles away. That was it, though. But they didn't have the swamp of corpses lying around, those cicada shells that are all nasty on the trees and stuff.
Another of my top news stories is both scientific and political, but it was when the Supreme Court ruled against gene patents, because I think that was it's a big story that has far-reaching consequences for science and for health and everyday life. It's going to And to me, it's a really interesting problem, something that, you know, moving forward as our science develops, as our technology develops, it's going to become a bigger and bigger issue. So I think that that's going to be kind of a landmark ruling that is going to set the tone for a lot of the discussions to come about this.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that was a good decision, too. You have to actually make it. You can't just find it.
Yep.
Well, just to go with Bob's ISON comet story, I loved that story, and I loved that in its disappointment, I kind of liked that it showed that there's a lot of stuff in science that we don't really know how it's going to come out. There's often this perceived idea that predictions are made and it's boring because we just know what's going to happen. We know when the sun's going to rise. You know when the moon's going to rise, and it can be kind of boring. But here was an example of, well, we're not sure what's going to happen. This might happen. It might burn up. It might go around the back. It might sort of do a combination of all those. And again, it sort of showed the interesting features of science, that there is so much that's unknown and that keeps it exciting, and that even the most expert people might not know how it's going to play out. And you can observe and be just as right or wrong as, you know, some expert's prediction. I liked that about that story a lot, that no one knew what was going to happen when it went behind the sun. And you had to wait and see, and you had to observe. And that to me was really like a big, big sort of science lesson that was associated with that.
Yeah, the tides go in, they go out. I mean,
yeah,
how does that happen?
Nobody knows. You can't explain it.
Magnets. You know?
There was a great story, a great news item about a team creating a system that had less than absolute zero temperature.
Yeah.
Which, remember that?
Yes.
To me, that was
negative temperature.
Negative temperature. It was fascinating because the science behind it was really, really cool, completely counterintuitive. And of course, so many, you know, reporters got it wrong because it was, they just didn't understand it. And it was kind of complicated, and it took a while for me to kind of wrap my head around it. And just real quick, the idea is that temperature, you know, also depends on weird things like the distribution of particle energies. And if you flip-flop those particle energies that you find in nature, you can get negative temperature. And it's just so it's not quite what you think, but it's still interesting and something that I hope a lot of people looked into and learned a little bit about.
I have a few that haven't gotten mentioned yet. I liked the universe might actually be a hologram, like the simulations.
Yeah, I didn't mention it because it was so recent and because I think that it's been I don't know. We haven't had a decent conversation about it. And
yes, we have. I covered that a year ago.
Exactly.
But just the idea that our universe may be a hologram is like one of those new ideas that I'd never heard before. I never would have thought of on my own. You know what I mean? Like the holographic universe. And simulations actually show that this is a viable way to model our universe. It's unbelievable.
It has been all over the news lately. Mm-hmm. With the resurgence of some new research. And maybe we should cover that again because,
we'll definitely be coming back to that.
That's incredible. If that's true, it's one of those things that if the universe is really like this, holy crap.
Imagine the size of the credit card.
Yeah,
right? That's a double hologram.
Nice, George.
If it has legs, that could be like dark matter, like one of those things, like, wow. The pitch drop experiment, the longest running experiment, deserves honorable mention. We may have discovered a new domain of life, the giant viruses. Not every year we discover a possible new domain of life.
I forgot about that.
That's why we do the review.
That's big.
Guys, we passed 1,000 exoplanets.
Yes.
And scientists think there are billions of Earths out there.
17 billion exoplanets in the Milky Way alone.
That's what I ended up going with on the interview last week. I was like, the discovery of a lot of Earth-like planets, I guess. And I was relieved that that actually was a thing this year when I looked it up. Like, oh, that wasn't a thing last year. That was okay.
Yeah.
It did happen.
All right, I also took the liberty of listing a few of the big science failures of the year. I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on this, but I'll name the ones I have.
Should I mention my two positive ones before we go to negative?
Yes,
or do you
should.
Should I come back to it?
No, go ahead. Hit it.
Quick mentions. Yay, dung beetles who use the stars at night to roll their little balls of dung around. And also, Merriam-Webster's word of the year?
Science.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Wink
the new word. The new word was selfie.
What's the new word?
Selfie.
Oxford, I think, made that. Oxford Dictionary made that theirs. This is Merriam-Webster's word of the year.
Yep.
But what does that mean? What does that mean? The word of the year. What does that mean?
The word that had the biggest, overall cultural, I guess, impact on the world.
All right. Well, that's one measure. But you guys, I looked up the Google top 10 search terms for 2013. Do you want to get really depressed and hear what they were?
Yeah, we talked about this.
Can we guess them first? Miley Cyrus.
Paul Walker.
Paul Walker's number two.
Yep.
Miley Cyrus was the number one person, but not on just the search term. Nelson Mandela.
Nelson Mandela.
Selfie.
Here are the other ones.
Sylvia Brown.
Nope. iPhone 5S. Corey Monteith. Harlem Shake. Boston Marathon. Royal Baby. Samsung Galaxy S4, PlayStation 4, and North Korea. Those are the top 10 search terms of 2013. You'll notice that science is not among them.
That's like the worst catalog you could ever get.
Boy. Yeah.
The Royal Baby.
How many of those were electronic gizmos or game consoles? Half of them?
Ugh. A few. All right, so my big science failures, bad science for the year, the Bigfoot DNA, the study that
proclaimed it.
Bigfoot DNA.
Oh my God.
Wah, wah, wah. This is just, it's human DNA with some anomalies. It's probably just bad technique.
Exactly.
The study purporting to show that vaccines make you gay. And the theory.
I don't remember that.
You remember the vaccines make you gay? The theory that people evolved from a hybridization between chimps and pigs.
It's a hybrid.
I do remember that.
Man-chimp-pig. You remember man? How could you forget man-chimp-pig?
And then my two
biggest disappointments of the year was the cicada non-invasion, and that Kepler broke this year, guys. Kepler broke. It's not doing its business anymore.
Aren't they repurposing it though?
Yeah, it's a diner.
I don't know.
Paperweight.
Yeah, it's a diner.
It's a drive-in. It's a fly-in.
But the Hubble is still chugging away though.
How about Ted screwing up the whole Rupert Sheldrake thing?
That was a million others.
That was a big fail. To wrap up our just our 2013 review, Jason Ferber is a listener who every year for the last few years has sent us a mashup of one of the rogues doing their thing. And this year, he sent us a mashup of Rebecca's wittier moments. So
hooray!
Let's take a listen.
I wouldn't call these witty.
It's a nice montage.
Tentacle penis. He's super popular with the ladies, though.
God damn it.
I murder people in video games. Professor seeks mother for cloned cave baby.
Poop. Shit. Yeah.
No, but I do know exactly where I am.
This is overdone. Over.
It's a fecal taco. Typos. Are they interested in my rectum? It's like a cactus.
Happy baby-free sex day.
Okay, you creep.
No, there is not, and don't call me Shirley. What?
Just really? Randomly injecting it with blood. Who knows?
Yeah. In Bob's pants.
Wrong! Dumb piece of horse shit. You're telling her to eat shit and die? I hate people so much sometimes.
Like a volcanic fart. Silent but deadly. Yeah, that's what it sounds like. You're going to die? No, it's obviously magic.
I wouldn't call it silly bullshit.
Did Egyptians have litter boxes?
You think this guy really just wants to fuck a pig?
Crazy band of drunken surgeons. Just the property to rock.
Did any of the rats get booked for Oprah?
Spiders.
Space spiders.
Global warming is a lie.
I was a very slow child.
You're just super high, Jack.
Such as the ball cock. And a Nazi. Hey, speaking of none of that.
I'm not wearing a habit.
You just gave a TED talk. I submit that that is not bananas. Tripping balls. There's a lot of timey-wimey, wibbly-wobbly stuff. Yes. You can't tell me why those crops failed. It must have been witches. I want to be a mole rat. She was an embarrassing failure of a psyche. You're just happy to see me. A giant lake of pig shit. Thank you so much, Jason. I'm honored to have been chosen this year. That was really
great.
Cool.
Great job. That must be a monumental amount of work.
Yeah.
Going
back through all that.
It's so awesome. Listen to our show. Yeah. Well, guys, we have to take a quick break from our review show to talk about this week's sponsor, Personal Capital. Now, George, I know you have hundreds of thousands of dollars to invest. How do you keep it all straight?
It's mostly colored rubber bands.
The colored rubber band system.
Yes.
Well, George, you should consider Personal Capital, and I'm dead serious, because it changes your ability to monitor all of your finances, all of your accounts, your checking account, your savings account, any investments that you have. It gives you a total real snapshot picture of your finances. And think about it. What's more important than your money, because you're building it towards your retirement, you're saving money for your college, your child's college tuitions. You have to be monitoring your money because nobody else is doing it like you would.
And it's a lot. It's basically science, because they give you graphs and charts and also reports. So and it's all free.
Speaking of free, just go to personalcapital.com/SGU. Sign up just takes a minute.
Your financial life is just going to get even more complicated tomorrow. So don't wait. Just get your free Personal Capital account now. personalcapital.com/SGU.
That's right. And if you have over $100,000 in investable assets, then you can also use Personal Capital for your wealth management solution. They charge very competitive fees to manage your wealth, your investments for you. So take a look. It's the basic service is free, personalcapital.com/SGU. All right, guys, let's get back to the show. We do like to also acknowledge some of the best and worst feedback that we get from our listeners over the year. Evan, you have something you said.
Okay, so honorable mention, we got an email from an unnamed source who said, "You're a dickhead." That was the whole email.
Was yours spelled correctly?
There was
yeah, no apostrophe.
I'm sorry, Evan. I forgot to sign that. I'm sorry. I totally forgot to sign that. I'm sorry.
Now I can reply properly. Okay, good. Here's something a little more cogent, yet definitely worst. Would like to point out how stupid your arguments are on vaccines. Even a percentage of those who get the vaccines get the virus or disease it is supposed to immunize you from. That, on top of many shots being completely unnecessary. The idea of immunization is good, but the problem comes in when shots are bad for you. Look it up. They are filled with poisons and cancer-causing viruses. Get a clue. Stop feeding the masses. Your BS and wrong opinions. And it's signed by someone.
Mm-hmm. Was that directed towards you, Evan?
No, that came to everyone. Here's the best one.
The best worst one?
No, this is best listener
feedback. Best one. Okay.
Best one. Best one. Right off the bat, let me say I'm a very religious person. I'm from Utah. You can guess what religion I belong to. I found the podcast about a year ago, and I listen religiously. I want to say thank you. Thank you, guys. And I think you guys sound like fantastic people, and I learn a lot about many subjects. You sparked my interest in many subjects I had no clue even existed. It's been a pleasure listening. I will continue to do so as long as I am able. The religion thing I mentioned was only mentioned so you could know that even though I have some different beliefs than you all do, I still really appreciate what you guys do. I do not know everything, well, very little to be honest, but I love the things you guys give me to think about and learn more about. I really appreciate what you guys do.
Wow.
Yeah, I really love getting emails from people who listen to us because they disagreed with us, but we're open enough to actually think about what we were saying rather than have some kind of knee-jerk negative reaction. Especially when they say, you know, that they changed the way they look at the world, you know, which is, you know, that's what we're trying to do, change the world. I want to mention two emails that are representative of types of emails that we get that I find the most irritating. And that's when people disagree with us on one topic and then they say something to the extent that because I disagree with you on this one issue, I'm not going to listen to you anymore. And then they make, instead of actually engaging with us on the facts that we're presenting, they just make assumptions about our political ideology. So in the last few months, I was accused of being a liberal because of our stance on global warming. Because if you promote the notion of global warming, then you are aiding the communist takeover of our country, and because communists are using the lie of global warming in order to blah, 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 right? So they basically say, they give a political ideological reason for opposing global warming and then accuse me specifically and us in general of being liberal because we go along with that. And then on the other side, because I corrected some propaganda misinformation about Monsanto, I'm also a libertarian who's pro-free market and is the number one promoter of Monsanto. So I'm a libertarian and a liberal, depending on which issue you disagree with me on. But neither of those people actually...
You're a libertarian.
I'm a libertarian. Didn't actually engage with me on the science. And when I tried to get them to that point, it's like, well, can we talk about, like, do you have any actual evidence or factual disagreement with me? When we get to that point, they just evaporate. I actually met, like, they say, they just make false accusations. Like, at least listen to what I'm saying. Don't respond to some imagined position that I have because it fits your ideology. Read what I'm actually saying and then address my facts and logic, my arguments, and then I will be happy to have a conversation with you about that. But when I actually tell, this is what I'm saying, here's the links. Like one person said, you never have any evidence to support that global warming is happening. Okay, here's 10 links. Hit me. Which one of these is wrong? This is the evidence that you say that we don't ever put forward. Nothing. Just evaporates. You know, that to me, those are the worst emails when people just want to accuse us of being shills or ideologues or evil or whatever and are not actually listening to what we're saying and engaging with us on the facts and evidence.
It is like a Rorschach test when people project what they want to into their enemy. Quote unquote. So if I don't agree with what you're saying because I don't understand what you're saying, then obviously we have to be politically different because then that makes my disagreement more expedient and easier. So they're just going to project whatever they want to into your thing, whether you're conservative or liberal or whatever. And you would think that the 10 links would be enough. But apart from these 10 links, what evidence do you have? And apart from those 10 links, what evidence do you have?
Yeah.
What else you got?
Annoying.
They're arguing against an archetype that they have erected in their head. You know, it's like, if you are on the global warming side of the equation, then you fit this archetype of that position. You don't have your own position. So they boil everything down to that. And of course, it's a horrific straw man. It's a fiction that they've erected in their mind. And that's it.
Let me ask you guys, has there ever been an instance where an email that you've received from a listener was presented in such a way that it did change your opinion or influenced your opinion? And what were the factors that made it influence you? What were those factors?
Absolutely.
I feel like that happens a lot.
We get experts that inform us, look, this is my field of research. I've worked the last 15 years doing this. You got the basics right, but let me give you some more nuances and clarifications.
In fact, George, we love those emails. I love when an expert emails us and gives us more information and fills in some gaps or makes some corrections. And we're perfectly happy to make corrections on the show. And we have the vast majority of our email with our listeners is a mutually constructive environment where we, the interaction that we have time for, we do, have very valuable discussions with people about everything that we discuss on the show.
In email, often I blog about the same topics in the comments of my blogs, you too, Rebecca. And also on our forums, we engage with people who are interested in the science and who give us some deeper information, even if they're not experts. We're talking to, 100,000 people or more. Somebody knows something that we don't know, and they add to the picture, or they correct a misconception that we had, or whatever.
Does one stand out for this year? Like, can you remember something happening?
I did a report on Bitcoin at Nexus last April. And it's a very complicated and deep topic, and I didn't recover it. I did not cover it as well as I should have.
A couple of months ago, I off the cuff cited a psychological study in support of some other news item we were talking about, and we got an email with the link to the study saying, actually, this came to the opposite conclusion. I'm sorry, I don't remember any more of the details, but on the following episode, we did a full correction on it. And one other one, about a month ago, a little more, I made a YouTube video about 23andMe, and it was like super pretty positive on it, but I did miss, I gave some negative possibilities of what 23andMe could offer, but I skipped a whole bunch of important stuff that came out later in the news and through geneticists emailing with me and telling me some more stuff I should mention. So by the time we covered it on SGU, I made sure to try to get all of those viewpoints in.
Yeah. All right. Guys, I do that almost every week. What I blog about on Monday or Tuesday is the item I'm planning to talk about on Wednesday. And I do that deliberately because I really read the comments carefully and I get a lot of good information and good feedback that I then incorporate into our discussion.
It's possible to influence you guys in a way. If you do it intelligently and if you present your argument in a cogent way, it's possible to have an influence. So it's very hopeful.
Of course.
Yeah. I wanted to throw a name out. Mike Hampton. We covered 3D printing, and we got a great email from this guy, Mike Hampton, who really broadened at least my appreciation and understanding of the current state of 3D printing and the future, and and how long it really probably will take before it really affects consumers at a consumer level, having it in your house.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm a little bit more pessimistic about how long it's going to take. So yeah, it happens quite frequently.
I would say every week.
My emails, I tend to get really nice. One of the better ones that I got in this past year was a geologist who started listening to my show because he, for some reason, thought it was about geology. and he said that, I tuned in and was expecting something about strata and, mica schist and things like that. And of course there was nothing. And, even though he was a scientist, he was a little bit of a woo believer as well in terms of, I think his wife was sort of into chiropractic and things like that. And so we started listening and got a different viewpoint and appreciated the fact that my non-geology show influenced him. That was really cool that I opened up a couple sort of new views in his head, even though he mistakenly was listening because he thought it was about geology. I love emails like that. And I'm actually quite lucky in that I get very few negative ones. I'm not sure what it is, or it's because that there are so few people listening. That's probably what it is. But I get very few negative emails. The only thing, I had one thing that happened the other day, a Twitter thing that you guys know this. There's that thing that sort of happens where you sort of say a joke or tweet a joke or blog something, and then someone explains the joke to you, like back to you. And it's like, so the other day I tweeted, I can't believe all this talk about whether a fictional character was white or black. Who cares? Thriller is the best album of all time. That was my tweet. And someone wrote back saying, are you talking about Jesus or Santa? And it was like, no, it's a Michael Jackson joke. Like, just read the whole, you have to read all of the characters that are in the, before, whatever. I know, and it's like only 100 and whatever it is. So just like get to the end before you reply. 40? That would be just, that's all I'm asking. Read the whole tweet and then make some,
People do email us and then they email us 10 minutes later and go, oh, I should have listened to the rest of the segment before I emailed.
They do that. Yes, they do.
Yeah. And one time, recently somebody sent us an email. I admit I got a little snarky in response, but I did put a happy smiley face at the end to make it okay. But
it's all good now.
Rebecca was talking about, I think, 23andMe, and then I made some response to Rebecca, and the guy emailed saying, making the exact 2 points that I made in response to Rebecca, as if we didn't make them on the show.
C's response is, those are excellent points that I made.
Yeah, right after Rebecca said
he's
that.
Such a jerk.
Well, I officially apologize. All right, Evan. You get to announce who won the 2013 Who's That Noisy Contest.
I'm excited.
It's exciting, yeah.
This is exciting.
What was your process, Ed? How do you pick how'd you pick the name?
All the names were placed into a mayonnaise jar, hermetically sealed. Was that Johnny Carson's bit?
Yeah, hidden under the Funkel's porch or
front
something.
Yeah, Winkin' Funkel's porch or something like that. No, I put all the names together, and I had my daughter Rachel close her eyes, and she went boink, and that was it. It's about as random as, you know, anything
changes
else.
To boink.
And this year, the grand prize winner is iPuppy. I-P-P-P-Y.
Oh, really?
Weird. Nice.
Awesome.
Who, back in our episode from the 11th of June, well, I'll play the noisy for you and see if this rings a bell.
We found that she could feel the vibration of spoken words.
Helen Keller's teacher.
That's right. Annie Sullivan. Helen Keller's teacher. One of, I love old recordings, rare recordings. Anything that can be salvaged from an era in which, because everything's recorded today, let's face it, but in an era in which everything was not recorded, to have those little pieces of history, oh gosh, I have an emotional connection to things like that. So Evan,
tell him what he's won.
iPuppy is going to be joining us in 2014 to play science or fiction with the rest of us rogues.
So we'll be in contact with iPuppy and we'll set that up probably or sometime in January.
iPuppy.
Yep. Very soon. So congratulations again.
Congratulations, iPuppy. iPuppy.
Well done.
All right, guys. We're going to move on to the in memoriam segment of the show. We obviously don't have time to do a full discussion of everybody on the list, but this is a list of skeptics, scientists, and some people on the other side who passed away in 2013. Evan, I asked you to make a list. I made a list. Tim Farley sent us his list that he works up every year. But we'll go around and say who sticks out for you guys. Do you guys remember who died this year that had an effect on you?
Well, definitely Narendra Dabhokar. Like, Narendra Dabhokar to me is the number one person. And Sylvia Brown. Call. Sylvia Brown.
I was
going to
say Sylvia Brown. Yeah, just the negative, the dark side. And the fact that she didn't live to her own projected age, her own, you know, the thing that she guessed is kind of sweet.
And on the same note, Harold Camping, who just died.
Just
a few days ago.
Who dies as one of the few people, maybe the only person in history, I think, who has died having completely gone back on his beliefs, his messianic beliefs. Because after the apocalypse did not happen the last time, he said that, because he did get it wrong several times, but then he finally said, you know what? I guess I was wrong. and then he promptly died, which makes him like the greatest, really. He's the only one, like, because every other guy would say, like, oh, but it turns out it's 5 years from now, you know?
Yeah. Is it a Darth Vader moment when he, like, for 5 minutes, he turns back to a clay and this good guy and then dies?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's a good metaphor.
Well, while we're on the dark side.
Scusi, mille regretti.
We have Sylvia Brown. We mentioned Harold Camping. Dwayne Gish. Don't forget Dwayne Gish died this year. The creationist, young Earth creationist, who made a career debating scientists, biologists.
Yep, he was a master debater.
Absolutely. We know.
Yep. And we mentioned Lloyd Pye a few episodes ago, Star Child fame. Dr. Jesse Marcel, who recognizes that name? He was the physician who claimed to have handled the Roswell crashed flying saucer debris. Jesse Marcel, his testimony became an icon of the whole Roswell.
So they mythology. Killed him. They finally killed him.
They finally killed him.
They shut him up later. Good.
What was it? 60 years or 65 years?
Slow acting poison.
Takes a while. You know?
Yeah. Paul Crouch, founder of Trinity Broadcasting Network and a televangelist.
Televangelist.
And we talked about Augusto Odon, father of Lorenzo, of Lorenzo's oil fame. Not really on the dark side, but I mean, somebody in skeptical circles.
Two-time Nobel Prize winner in chemistry, Frederick Sanger.
Frederick Sanger, died, absolutely.
Yep. Died the
Age
day
95.
Before Sylvia Brown did.
95. Yep,
it was
good
a
run.
Nice. Yep. It was a nice contrast to make between Sanger and Sylvia Brown, who died the next day, to say, you know, here's someone who did great things for science, and here's someone who actually, you know, did terrible things as far as the world of science goes. Let's see a couple other names. Amar Bose, founder of the Bose Corporation, died. And someone else from the audio world, Ray Dolby.
Dolby,
sound pioneer, Dolby Audio, also died. A couple of authors also died. Tom Clancy wrote a lot about science in the military, amongst other military-related things. Frederick Pohl, science fiction writer.
Very good.
See, what book do I have? Writer. Merchant's War. I'm looking over at my bookshelf right now. I see his book, Merchant's War, right over there.
In the science fiction world, Michael Ansara. Anyone?
Yes, Klingon.
Kang.
Yes. Track.
Yeah. Kang from Star Trek Original Series. Yeah, good, Bob. And Jim Kelly.
Enter the Dragon?
Enter the Dragon, Bob. Yes.
5 points. Wow.
You got it.
Bob, well, what did he do for Enter the Dragon? What was he?
Just going out in the moonlight, baby.
You can Oh, that guy? Oh, I love him.
Bye. He had a wicked six-pack. What a six-pack he had.
Yep.
Damn.
Scott Carpenter, astronaut.
Jim Kelly died. Damn.
Second U.S. astronaut in orbit. The Aaron Swartz I mentioned because he had a hand in developing RSS, Really Simple Syndication, which makes our podcast possible.
Yeah.
So he's got to get a mention.
That was a really tragic story, too.
Douglas Engelbart. Yeah, thanks, Sam. Douglas Engelbart, father of the computer mouse, and Andre Cassagnus, who invented the Etch-a-Sketch. The last one on my list is Virginia Johnson of Masters and Johnson. Yeah. Yep, innovated a lot of sex science,
sexual,
and now has a sex HBO special.
At the Etch-a-Sketch funeral procession, it only made sharp right and left turns. I don't know if you, as they were, couldn't fit around in a thing. Yeah. Boo.
And Hans Reigel, the inventor of gummy bears, died.
Mm-hmm. Gummy bears.
Wow. Gummy bears. He needs a Nobel Prize. Did he ever get one? Because if you invented gummy bears...
No, but he was very popular. He was a confectionery king of Germany way back when.
Your business depends on software. All your apps, your databases, your social media, your account management, your e-commerce. Everything you do in business relies on software. So the very last thing you need is a problem with it. New Relic's software analytics give you powerful, real-time insights into your software so you can spot problems and fix them before they become
big business-stopping problems.
Plus, you got web and mobile apps, right?
Of course you do.
You can't be in business today without a strong presence online. So let me ask you, do you have any clue how they're performing? With New Relic, you can stop wondering and start knowing how your apps are performing because New Relic gives you full code-level visibility into their real-time performance.
Give New Relic a try free for 30 days.
Go to newrelic.com/radio That's NEWRELIC.com/radio. NewRelic.com/radio.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious. I then challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. I don't know if you remember, but every year for the review show, I do three science or fiction items from earlier in the year. All you have to do is remember earlier episodes in the year. Okay.
God.
All right, here we go. Item number one. Scientists discover quadruple helix DNA in human cells. Item number two. Researchers find that bilingual children have a significantly higher IQ score compared to matched monolingual controls. And item number three. Scientists discover the mechanism by which the single-celled organism Tetrahymena thermophily has seven sexes. George, as our guest this week, you get to go first.
I get to go first. Oh, my gosh. All right. Item number one with your quadruple Felix. I don't think there's a quadruple Felix because there's only one Felix. Oh, no, I'm reading that wrong. Sorry, quadruple helix. That one I like, and I think that's true. So I like that one because I heard about DNA on a newscast once, so that must be fine. Number two, the bilingual children. Now, as a bilingual child, I don't know if you're aware. I haven't talked about this enough, but I was raised Ukrainian, so bilingual children have a significantly higher IQ. I would be the eliminating factor in that. So I'm going to say that one probably is not true, because I think the bilingual thing is oversold. And then third, the scientists discover the mechanism of Tetrahymena thermophile with seven sexes. Only seven? If it was like 15, I would think that's not true. So I'm going to go item number two with the bilingual thing, just because I know that I am often the dumbest guy in the room. So that's the fiction.
All right, Jay.
I think I agree with George. In short, I do think that the bilingual thing is overrated as far as IQ goes. I think it probably helps in other ways.
Okay, Bob.
Yeah, I'm going with the IQ one. That's fiction. I hope.
Very pithy from Bob this week. Evan.
Quadruple helix DNA in human cells. You double your pleasure, double your fun, I guess. Quadruple helix. That's sure. Okay, why not? IQ one, bilingual children, no, they do not have significantly higher IQ score. That one will be the fiction.
Okay, Rebecca, you are the reigning queen from last year, from 2012, which is why you get to go last, the last answer of 2013.
Well, for me, it was between the quadruple helix and the bilingual children. And I am heavily swayed by my compatriots. I vaguely recall this. so there's that. And I think that Jay is correct. I think that the actual research was something along the lines of bilingual children did show significant gains in certain areas. Like it might have been like their ability to pick up information or something. I don't remember exactly, but yeah, maybe it's not higher IQ. So I'll go with the team, the IQ one.
You all five of you are in agreement on number two. So let's start with number one. Scientists discover quadruple helix DNA in human cells. You all think that one is science, and that one is science.
Yay.
Good job. Yep, this one is from an earlier episode, unaltered. This is the January 20th, 2013 news item. Cambridge researchers find on the 60th anniversary of Watson and Crick. Now, they had observed this in vitro previously, but this is the first time they observed DNA forming into a quadruple helix, four strands bound together as opposed to the normal two strands in the double helix. And they also discovered that this is more likely to occur when cells are dividing. And if you look at cells that rapidly divide, like cancer cells, they are more likely to have these quadruple-stranded DNAs. And that may lead, of course, this has to lead potentially to a cure for cancer, right? That's because every scientific discovery has to lead to either a cure for the common cold or a cure for cancer or longer life or whatever. So, yeah, that one is true. Very interesting. Let's go on to number two. Researchers find that bilingual children have a significantly higher IQ score compared to matched monolingual controls. You all, following George's lead, think that this one is the fiction. So George gets pretty much all the credit either way. And this one is the fiction.
Yeah!
G-O.
Yeah.
Good job, everyone. This item, when I included it earlier in the year, was a science. I reversed it. I made it into a fiction for this episode. So the science item.
Ah, Trixie.
Trixie is that bilingual children have a better working memory and executive function skills than monolingual children. The research, I did a little bit of review of this whole research question, though. I had to make sure, first of all, that the IQ bit wasn't true. And interestingly, very quickly, in the first half of the 20th century, research showed that monolingual children performed better in cognitive testing than bilingual children. It was thought that being bilingual was a disadvantage. In the latter half of the 20th century, it flipped. And research started to show that bilingual children were performing better on standardized testing, whatever they were looking for. But then it was realized that there was a selection bias, that bilingual children were not really matched properly to their monolingual controls. And when that was accounted for, the advantages went away.
Fuck.
So now there's a more nuanced view, in that being bilingual has an advantage in some areas, specifically some meta-language areas, which makes sense. So the people who are bilingual are better at thinking about the way grammar works and the way language works. Maybe they might be a little bit better in certain kinds of puzzle solving because the fact that they know two different languages forces them to think about how languages work. And they have advantages in, because they have to suppress one of the languages that they know, they have superior inhibitory control, which is probably where the executive function comes from. Very interesting. So in some areas, there's really no difference, like IQ, no difference. In some areas, there's a slight advantage. In some areas, there's a slight disadvantage to being bilingual. So it's a more complicated relationship. Scientists discover the mechanism by which the single-celled organism Tetrahymena thermophilae has seven sexes. That one also is science. Yay. This is a single-celled organism that comes in seven sexes, and geneticists sorted out the genes that determine which of those seven sexes an individual will be. That was news. That was a fiction, though. When I originally included it, I said that it was a lizard and not a single-celled organism, and that's what made it fiction.
Yeah.
All right, so Bob, you have the stats for science or fiction, which and you will instantly adjust them for everyone's recent win.
All right, fourth place is Evan with 42%.
As long as I beat, you know, Chance, I'm happy.
I know,
you beat,
right?
The dice.
Chance.
And,
Chance gets his ass kicked all the time. Poor guy.
In third place is me with 45.65%. Wow.
You had a bad year.
Second place, yeah, it was horrific. Second place, Jay with 55.1020%.
Oh, Jay,
nice.
Yeah,
thank you. Well, thank
nice,
you.
Jay.
That's incredible, Jay.
And it is. And Rebecca wins yet again, and she just eked above 59 with this last win, 60.4.
Wow.
She's got the best one, 60.41666%.
Nice.
Oh, evil person. Congratulations,
Rebecca.
Just
round
that up.
See, well, maybe you guys should take a lesson from this, and you should quit your day jobs and do skepticism for the
full time.
Read science articles.
Hey, guys, I also wanted to thank Jonathan Tindall and Brandon Osborne for putting in some time to help me out to compile these statistics. It was a lot of episodes to go through. So thanks again, guys.
Guys, it's been fun being your quiz master once again this year.
Great job, yeah. Steve.
Good job.
Yeah, really, really great.
Much appreciated.
About every 3 weeks.
Maybe next year I'll let you guys take the reins more often.
Yeah.
We have a few announcements before we get to the quote to close out the year. Our conferences for 2014. Nexus will be April 11th to 13th. April 11th to 13th, so mark your calendar.
Nexus.
We will be formally announcing our speaker list, so keep an eye out for that, hopefully within the next few weeks.
Nelson Mandela.
And this is pretty exciting. This is exciting. We are going to Australia and New Zealand next fall, really. Our time. So,
that's November 2014, right, Steve?
Yeah, so Australia conference will be in Sydney, November 28th to 30th, and Auckland, New Zealand, December 5th through 7th.
And when we say everybody, we mean including George Rubb.
George will be joining
Yay!
Us.
Yay! Oh my gosh. Yes. I'm allowed in that country again? Cool.
Yeah, they're going to allow you back in the country.
I get to hang out with George for 2 weeks.
Oh my goodness gracious. Get the video camera ready.
I'd like to thank all of you. I had a great year of podcasting. Yeah. I feel like we did good work this year. I think that
absolutely
that we've done some of our best programming as well this year, and I'm happy to be knowing and working with all of you. Again, let's do it another year.
You think so?
Ditto.
Definitely, all right. Jay.
One more.
Here.
One more. All right, so to land this plane of the year, I've got a very awesome quote that Steve in particular is going to love. This was sent in by a listener named Allison Hoffman. Allison's from Canada. She's a fan of Doctor Who, and this is a quote from Doctor Who: The Reboot, Season 1, Episode 3.
Nice.
Fictional Charles Darwin character is speaking to the Doctor and says, "Can it be that I have the world entirely wrong?" And the Doctor says, "Not wrong. There's just more to learn."
Hear, hear.
Excellent. Love it.
Generally, you'd go with fictional or fictitious, but I do like fictitional.
Did I say fictitional?
I think so.
That's good for me.
I liked it, though. It's
perfectly chronic.
It embiggens your vocabulary.
All right. There may be some changes to the SGU in 2014. Every year we like to shake things up a little bit, maybe shuffle things around, introduce some new segments. Yeah, so if you have any ideas or feedback about which segments you'd like to see us keep or maybe get rid of or maybe add, let us know. But keep an eye out for some new stuff from the SGU in 2014.
What do you mean, Steve? Like, what are you talking, like non-podcast specific stuff?
Well, the podcast itself, but, you know, we also have other projects in the works.
Oh, yes, we do.
Projects in the video end of things, the video realm.
George, thanks for sitting in.
Yeah, thanks, George.
Guys, thank you so much. Always nice to be on, and congratulations to another successful year for you kids. My goodness.
Thank you, sir. Always impressive.
Thank you.
And you too, thanks, George. You are getting quite the longevity in the podcast.
Yes, I remember back in 2006 when we started this whole shindig.
Odd six.
Yes, back when RSS was mono.
I don't even know what that means, but yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for joining me this week and this year.
Thank you, Steve.
Likewise, Steve. Great year.
Surely.
And until next year, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. And now that the show's over, don't forget to sign up for your free account with Personal Capital right now. With Personal Capital, you'll finally be able to see all your accounts in one place and get a clear view of everything you own. To sign up for free, go to theskepticsguide.org and click on the Personal Capital banner, or go to personalcapital.com/SGU. Personal Capital, less fees, more G's.